Undaunted by the steamy tempo of Wild Root, Hermy Betcher slides into a backstep, extends his arm, and spins Rebecca around. On the first beat of the next bar, he catches her in his arms and reverses direction, spinning them both toward the far end of the platform, where Alice Weathers stands next to Mr. Torvaldsen, gazing up at Symphonic Stan.
"The special lady must be you," Hermy says, "because that perfume of yours is worth a dedication."
Rebecca asks, "Where'd you learn to dance like this?"
"My brother and I, we were town boys. Learned how to dance in front of the jukebox in Alouettes over by Arden."
Rebecca knows Alouettes on Arden's Main Street, but what was once a soda fountain is now a lunch counter, and the jukebox disappeared around the time Johnny Mathis dropped off the charts.
"You want a good dancer, you find yourself a town boy. Tom, now, he was always the slickest dancer around, and you can plunk him in that chair, but you can't take away his rhythm."
"Mr. Stan? You who Mr. Stan?"
Alice Weathers has tilted her head and cupped her hands around her mouth.
"Do you take requests?"
A voice as flat and hard as the sound of two stones grinding together says,
"I was here first, old woman."
This implacable rudeness brings Rebecca to a halt. Hermy's right foot comes gently down atop her left, then swiftly moves off, doing her no more injury than a kiss. Towering over Alice, Charles Burnside glares at Torvald Torvaldsen. Torvaldsen steps back and tugs at Alice's hand.
"Certainly, my dear," says Stan, bending down. "Tell me your name and what you'd like to hear."
"I am Alice Weathers, and
I was here first," Bernie loudly repeats.
Rebecca glances at Hermy, who shakes his head and makes a sour face. Town boy or not, he is as intimidated as Mr. Torvaldsen.
"Moon Glow, please, by Benny Goodman."
"It's my turn, you jackass. I want that Woody Herman number called Lady McGowan's Nightmare. That one's good."
Hermy leans toward Rebecca's ear.
"Nobody likes that fella, but he gets his own way."
"Not this time," Rebecca says.
"Mr. Burnside, I want you to..." Symphonic Stan silences her with a wave of his hand. He turns to face the owner of the remarkably unpleasant voice.
"No can do, mister. The song is called Lady McGowan's Dream, and I didn't bring that snappy little item with me this afternoon. Sorry."
"Okay, bud, how about I Can't Get Started, the one Bunny Berrigan did?"
"Oh, I love that," Alice says. "Yes, play I Can't Get Started."
"Happy to oblige," Stan says in Henry Layden's normal voice. Without bothering to jive around or spin the records on his hands, he simply exchanges the LP on the turntable for one from the first box. He seems oddly wilted as he steps to the mic and says, "I've flown around the world on a plane. I settled revolutions in Spain. Can't get started. Dedicated to the lovely Alice Bluegown and the one who walks by night."
"You're no better'n a monkey on a stick," says Bernie.
The music begins. Rebecca taps Hermy on the arm and moves up alongside Charles Burnside, for whom she has never felt anything but mild revulsion. Now that she has him in focus, her outrage and disgust cause her to say, "Mr. Burnside, you are going to apologize to Alice and to our guest here. You're a crude, obnoxious bully, and after you apologize, I want you to get back into your room where you belong." Her words have no effect. Burnside's shoulders have slumped. He has a wide, sloppy grin on his face, and he is staring empty-eyed at nothing in particular. He looks too far gone to remember his own name, much less Bunny Berrigan's. In any case, Alice Weathers has danced away, and Symphonic Stan, back at the far end of the platform and out of the pink spot, appears to be deep in thought. The elderly couples sway back and forth on the dance floor. Off to the side, Hermy Betcher pantomimes dancing and quizzes her with a look.
"I'm sorry about that," she says to Stan/Henry.
"No need to apologize. I Can't Get Started was my wife's favorite record. I've been thinking about her a lot the past few days. Sort of took me by surprise." He runs a hand over his sleek hair and shakes out his arms, visibly getting back into his role.
Rebecca decides to leave him alone. In fact, she wants to leave everyone alone for a little while. Signaling regret and the press of duty to Hermy, she makes her way through the crowd and exits the common room. Somehow, old Bernie has beaten her to the corridor. He shuffles absently toward Daisy Wing, head drooping, feet scuffing the floor. "Mr. Burnside," she says, "your act may fool everyone else, but I want you to know that it doesn't fool me." Moving by increments, the old man turns around. First one foot shifts, then a knee, the spavined waist, the second foot, finally the cadaverous trunk. The ugly bloom of Bernie's head droops on its thin stalk, offering Rebecca a view of his mottled scalp. His long nose protrudes like a warped rudder. With the same dreadful slowness, his head lifts to reveal muddy eyes and a slack mouth. A flash of sheer vindictiveness rises into the dull eyes, and the dead lips writhe. Frightened, Rebecca takes an instinctive step backward. Bernie's mouth has moved all the way into a horrible grin. Rebecca wants to escape, but anger at having been humiliated by this miserable jerk lets her hold her ground.
"Lady McGowan had a bad, bad nightmare," Bernie informs her. He sounds drugged or half asleep. "And Lady Sophie had a nightmare. Only hers was worse." He giggles. "The king was in his counting house, counting out his honeys. That's what Sophie saw when she fell asleep."
His giggling rises in pitch, and he says something that might be Mr. Munching. His lips flap, revealing yellow, irregular teeth, and his sunken face undergoes a subtle change. A new kind of intelligence seems to sharpen his features.
"Does you know Mr. Munchun? Mr. Munchun and his little friend Gorg? Does you know what happened in Chicago?"
"Stop this right now, Mr. Burnside."
"Does you know of Fritz Harmon, him who was so lovely? They called him the vamp of Hanover. Yes, they did. Everybody has God's nightmares all the time. Oh.
"Stop talking like that," Rebecca shouts. "You're not fooling me."
For a moment, the new intelligence flares within Bernie's dim eyes. It almost instantly retreats. He licks his lips and says,
"Wake up, Burn."
"Whatever," Rebecca says. "Dinner is downstairs at 7 if you want it. Go take a nap or something, will you?"
Bernie gives her a peeved, murky look and plops a foot down on the floor, beginning the tedious process that will turn him around again.
"You could write it down. Fritz Harmon in Hanover."
His mouth twists into a smile of unsettling slyness.
"When the king comes here, maybe we can dance together."
"No, thanks." Rebecca turns her back on the old horror and clacks down the hallway on her high heels, uncomfortably aware of his eyes following her.
Rebecca's nice little Coach handbag lies flat on her desk in the windowless vestibule to Chipper's office. Before going in, she pauses to rip off a sheet of notepaper, write down Fritz Harmon, ? Hanover, ? And slip the paper into the bag's central compartment. It might be nothing, it probably is, but who knows? She is furious that she let Burnside frighten her, and if she can find a way to use his nonsense against him, she will do her best to expel him from Maxton's.
"Kiddo, is that you?" Chipper calls out.
"No, it's Lady McGowan and her freaking nightmare." She strides into Chipper's office and finds him behind his desk, happily counting out the bills contributed that afternoon by the sons and daughters of his clientele.
"My little Becky looks all ticked off," he says. "What happened? One of our zombies stomp on your foot?"
"Don't call me Becky."
Hey, cheer up.
You won't believe how much your silver-tongued boyfriend conned out of the relatives today. 126 smackers, free money. Okay, what went wrong anyhow?
Charles Burnside spooked me, that's what. He ought to be in a mental hospital.
Are you kidding? That particular zombie is worth his weight in gold. As long as Charles Burnside can draw breath into his body, he will always have a place in my heart.
Grinning, he brandishes a handful of bills.
And if you have a place in my heart, honey baby, you'll always have a place at Maxton's.
The memory of Burnside saying the king was in his counting house, counting out his honeys, makes her feel unclean. If Chipper were not grinning in that exultant, loose-lipped way, Rebecca supposes he would not remind her so unpleasantly of his favorite resident.
Everybody has God's nightmares, all the dime.
That wasn't a bad description of the fisherman's French landing. Funny, you wouldn't think old Bernie would take more notice of those murders than Chipper. Rebecca had never heard him mention the fisherman's crimes. Apart from the time he groused that he would not be able to tell anyone he was going fishing until Dale Gilbertson finally got off his big fat butt, and what kind of crappy deal was that?
Chapter 8. Two telephone calls, and another private matter, one he is doing his best to deny, have conspired to pluck Jack Sawyer from his cocoon in Norway Valley and put him on the road to French Landing, Sumner Street, and the police station. The first call had been from Henry, and Henry, calling from the Maxton cafeteria during one of the Symphonic One's breaks, had insisted on speaking his mind. A child had apparently been abducted from the sidewalk in front of Maxton's earlier that day. Whatever Jack's reasons for staying out of the case, which, by the way, he had never explained, they didn't count anymore, sorry. This made four children who had been lost to the fishermen, because Jack didn't really think Irma Freneau was going to walk in her front door anytime soon, did he? Four children. No, Henry had said, I didn't hear about it on the radio. It happened this morning. From a janitor at Maxton's, Henry had said. He saw a worried-looking cop pick up a bicycle and put it in his trunk. All right, Henry had said, maybe I don't know for certain, but I am certain. By tonight, Dale will identify the poor kid, and tomorrow his name will be all over the newspaper. And then this whole county is going to flip out. Don't you get it? Just knowing you are involved will do a lot to keep people calm. You no longer have the luxury of retirement, Jack. You have to do your part. Jack had told him he was jumping to conclusions and that they would talk about it later. 45 minutes later, Dale Gilbertson had called with the news that a boy named Tyler Marshall had vanished from in front of Maxton sometime that morning, and that Tyler's father, Fred Marshall, was down there right now in the station, demanding to see Jack Sawyer. Fred was a great guy, a real straight arrow and family man, a solid citizen, a friend of Dale's, you could say. But at the moment, he was at the end of his rope. Apparently Judy, his wife, had been having some kind of mental problems even before the trouble started, and Tyler's disappearance had driven her off the edge. She talked in gibberish, injured herself, tore the house apart. And I kind of know Judy Marshall, Dale had said. Beautiful, beautiful woman. A little thing, but tough as all get out on the inside, both feet on the ground, a great person, a tremendous person. Someone you'd think would never lose her grip no matter what. It seems she thought, knew, whatever, that Tyler had been snatched even before his bicycle turned up. Late this afternoon, she got so bad, Fred had to call Dr. Scarda and get her over to French County Lutheran in Arden, where they took one look at her and put her in Ward D, the mental wing. So you can imagine the kind of shape Fred's in. He insists on talking to you. I have no confidence in you, he said to me. Well, Dale had said, if you don't come down here, Fred Marshall is going to show up at your house. That's what'll happen. I can't put the guy on a leash, and I'm not going to lock him up just to keep him away from you. On top of everything else, we need you here, Jack. All right, Dale had said. I know you're not making any promises, but you know what you should do. Would these conversations have been enough to get him into his pickup and on the road to Sumner Street? Very likely, Jack imagines, which renders the third factor, the secret, barely acknowledged one, inconsequential. It means nothing. A silly attack of nerves, a buildup of anxiety, completely natural under the circumstances. The kind of thing that could happen to anybody. He felt like getting out of the house, so what? No one could accuse him of escaping. He was traveling toward, not running away from, that which he most wanted to escape, the dark undertow of the fisherman's crimes. Neither was he committing himself to any deeper involvement. A friend of Dale's and the father of a child apparently missing, this Fred Marshall, insisted on talking to him. Fine, let him talk. If half an hour with a retired detective could help Fred Marshall get a handle on his problems, the retired detective was willing to give him the time. Everything else was merely personal. Waking dreams and robin's eggs messed with your mind, but that was merely personal. It could be outweighed, outwitted, figured out. No rational person took that stuff seriously. Like a summer storm, it blew in, it blew out. Now, as he coasted through the green light at Centralia and noted with a cop's reflexive awareness the row of Harleys lined up in the sandbar's parking lot, he felt himself coming into alignment with the afternoon's difficulties. It made perfect sense that he should have found himself unable, well, let us say unwilling, to open the refrigerator door. Nasty surprises made you think twice. A light in his living room had expired, and when he had gone to the drawer that contained half a dozen new halogen bulbs, he had been unable to open it. In fact, he had not quite been able to open any drawer, cabinet, or closet in his house, which had denied him the capacity to make a cup of tea, change his clothes, prepare lunch, or do anything but leaf half-heartedly through books and watch television. When the flap of the mailbox had threatened to conceal a pyramid of small blue eggs, he had decided to put off collecting the mail until the next day. Anyhow, all he ever got were financial statements, magazines, and junk mail. Let's not make it sound worse than it was, Jack says to himself. I could have opened every door, drawer, and cabinet in the place, but I didn't want to. I wasn't afraid that robin's eggs were going to come spilling out of the refrigerator or the closet. It's just that I didn't want to take the chance of finding one of the blasted things. Show me a psychiatrist who says that's neurotic, and I'll show you a moron who doesn't understand psychology. All the old-timers used to tell me that working homicide messed with your head. Hell, that's why I retired in the first place. What was I supposed to do, stay on the force until I ate my gun? You're a smart guy, Henry Layden, and I love you, but there are some things you don't get. All right, he was going to Sumner Street. Everybody was yelling at him to do something, and that's what he was doing. He'd say hello to Dale, greet the boys, sit down with his Fred Marshall, the solid citizen with a missing son, and give him the usual oatmeal about everything possible being done, blah, blah. The FBI is working hand in glove with us on this one, and the Bureau has the finest investigators in the world. That oatmeal. As far as Jack was concerned, his primary duty was to stroke Fred Marshall's fur, as if to soothe the feelings of an injured cat. When Marshall had calmed down, Jack's supposed obligation to the community, an obligation that existed entirely in the minds of others, would be fulfilled, freeing him to go back to the privacy he had earned. If Dale didn't like it, he could take a running jump into the Mississippi. If Henry didn't like it, Jack would refuse to read Bleak House and force him to listen instead to Lawrence Welk, Vaughn Monroe, or something equally excruciating, Bad Dixieland. Years ago, someone had given Jack a CD called Fats Manassas and His Muskrat All-Stars Stompin' the Ramble. 30 seconds of Fats Manassas and Henry would be begging for mercy. This image makes Jack feel comfortable enough to prove that his hesitation before cupboards and drawers had been merely a temporary unwillingness, not phobic inability. Even while his attention was elsewhere, as it chiefly was, the shoved-in ashtray below the dash has mocked and taunted him since he first climbed into the pickup. A kind of sinister suggestiveness, an aura of latent malice, surrounds the ashtray's flat little panel. Does he fear that a small blue egg lurks behind the little panel? Of course not. Nothing is in there but air and molded black plastic. In that case, he can pull it out. The buildings on the outskirts of French Landing glide past the pickup's windows. Jack has reached almost the exact point at which Henry pulled the plug on Dirty Sperm. Obviously, he can open the ashtray. Nothing could be simpler. You just get your fingers under there and tug. Easiest thing in the world. He extends a hand. Before his fingers touch the panel, he snatches the hand back. Drops of perspiration glide down his forehead and lodge in his eyebrows. "It isn't a big deal," he says aloud. "You got some kind of problem here, Jackie boy?" Again, he extends his hand to the ashtray. Abruptly aware that he is paying more attention to the bottom of his dashboard than to the road, he glances up and cuts his speed by half. He refuses to hit his brakes. It's just an ashtray, for God's sake. His fingers meet the panel, then curl under its lip. Jack glances at the road once more. Then, with the decisiveness of a nurse ripping a strip of tape off a patient's hairy abdomen, he yanks out the sliding tray. The lighter attachment, which he had unknowingly dislodged in his driveway that morning, bounces 3 inches into the air, greatly resembling, to Jack's appalled eye, a flying black and silver egg. He veers off the road, bumps over the weedy shoulder, and heads toward a looming telephone pole. The lighter drops back into the tray with a loud metallic thwack no egg in the world could have produced. The telephone pole swims closer and nearly fills the windshield. Jack stamps on the brake and jerks to a halt, arousing a flurry of ticks and rattles from the ashtray. If he had not cut his speed before opening the ashtray, he would have driven straight into the pole, which stands about 4 feet from the hood of the pickup. Jack wipes the sweat off his face and picks up the lighter. Shit on a shingle. He clicks the attachment into its receptacle and collapses backward against the seat. "No wonder they say smoking can kill you," he says. The joke is too feeble to amuse him, and for a couple of seconds he does nothing but slump against the seat and regard the sparse traffic on Lyle Road. When his heart rate drops back to something like normal, he reminds himself that he did, after all, open the ashtray. Blonde, rumpled Tom Lund has evidently been prepped for his arrival, for when Jack walks past 3 bicycles lined up next to the door and enters the station, the young officer takes off from behind his desk and rushes forward to whisper that Dale and Fred Marshall are waiting for him in Dale's office, and he will show him right in. They'll be glad to see him, that's for sure. "I am too, Lieutenant Sawyer," Lund adds. "Boy, I gotta say it. What you got, I think we need." "Call me Jack. I'm not a lieutenant anymore. I'm not even a cop anymore." Jack had met Tom Lund during the Kinderling investigation, and he had liked the young man's eagerness and dedication. In love with his job, his uniform and his badge, respectful of his chief and awed by Jack, Lund had uncomplainingly logged hundreds of hours on the telephone, in records offices, and in his car, checking and rechecking the often contradictory details spun off by the collision between a Wisconsin farm insurance salesman and a Sunset Strip working girl. All the while, Tom Lund had retained the energetic sparkle of a high school quarterback running onto the field for his first game. "He does not look that way anymore," Jack observes. Dark smudges hang beneath his eyes, and the bones in his face are more prominent. More than sleeplessness and exhaustion lie behind Lund's affect. His eyes bear the helplessly startled expression of those who have suffered a great moral shock. The fisherman has stolen a good part of Tom Lund's youth. "But I'll see what I can do," Jack says, offering the promise of a commitment greater than he intends. "We can sure use anything you can give us," Lund says. It is too much, too servile. And as Lund turns away and leads him to the office, Jack thinks, "I didn't come here to be your savior." The thought instantly makes him feel guilty. Lund knocks, opens the door to announce Jack, shows him in, and vanishes like a ghost, utterly unnoticed by the 2 men who rise from their chairs and fasten their eyes upon their visitor's face, one with visible gratitude, the other with an enormous degree of the same emotion mixed with naked need, which makes Jack even more uncomfortable. Over Dale's garbled introduction, Fred Marshall says, "Thank you for agreeing to come. Thank you so much. That's all I can..." His right arm sticks out like a pump handle. When Jack takes his hand, an even greater quantity of feeling floods into Fred Marshall's face. His hand fastens on Jack's and seems almost to claim it, as an animal claims its prey. He squeezes hard a considerable number of times. His eyes fill. "I can't..." Marshall pulls his hand away and scrubs the tears off his face. Now his eyes look raw and intensely vulnerable.
"Boy, oh boy," he says. "I'm really glad you're here, Mr. Sawyer. Or should I say Lieutenant?"
"Jack is fine. Why don't the two of you fill me in on what happened today?" Dale points toward a waiting chair. The three men take their places. The painful but essentially simple story of Fred, Judy, and Tyler Marshall begins. Fred speaks first at some length. In his version of the story, a valiant, lion-hearted woman, a devoted wife and mother, succumbs to baffling, multifaceted transformations and disorders and develops mysterious symptoms overlooked by her ignorant, stupid, self-centered husband. She blurts out nonsense words, she writes crazy stuff on sheets of notepaper, rams the papers into her mouth and tries to swallow them. She sees the tragedy coming in advance, and it unhinges her. Sounds crazy, but the self-centered husband thinks it's the truth. That is, he thinks it's the truth, because he's been thinking about it since he first talked to Dale, and even though it sounds crazy, it kind of makes sense. Because what other explanation could there be? So that's what he thinks, that his wife started to lose her mind because she knew that the fisherman was on the way. Things like that are possible, he guesses. For example, the brave, afflicted wife knew that her beautiful, wonderful son was missing even before the stupid, selfish husband, who went to work exactly as if it were a normal day, told her about the bicycle. That pretty much proved what he was talking about. The beautiful little boy went out with his three friends, but only the three friends came back, and Officer Danny Cheetah found the little son's Schwinn bike and one of his poor sneakers on the sidewalk outside Maxton's. "Danny Cheetah?" asks Jack, who, like Fred Marshall, is beginning to think he thinks a number of alarming things. "Cheetah," says Dale and spells it for him. Dale tells his own, far shorter version of the story. In Dale Gilbertson's story, a boy goes out for a ride on his bicycle and vanishes, perhaps as a result of abduction from the sidewalk in front of Maxton's. That is all of the story Dale knows, and he trusts that Jack Sawyer will be able to fill in many of the surrounding blanks. Jack Sawyer, at whom both of the other men in the room are staring, takes time to adjust to the three thoughts he now thinks he thinks. The first is not so much a thought as a response that embodies a hidden thought. From the moment Fred Marshall clutched his hand and said, "Boy, oh boy," Jack found himself liking the man. An unanticipated turn in the evening's plot. Fred Marshall strikes him as something like the poster boy for small-town life. If you put his picture on billboards advertising French County real estate, you could sell a lot of second homes to people in Milwaukee and Chicago. Marshall's friendly, good-looking face and slender runner's body are as good as testimonials to responsibility, decency, good manners and good neighborliness, modesty, and a generous heart. The more Fred Marshall accuses himself of selfishness and stupidity, the more Jack likes him. And the more he likes him, the more he sympathizes with his terrible plight, the more he wishes to help the man. Jack had come to the station expecting that he would respond to Dale's friend like a policeman, but his cop reflexes have rusted from disuse. He is responding like a fellow citizen. Cops, as Jack well knows, seldom view the civilians caught up in the backwash of a crime as fellow citizens, certainly never in the early stages of an investigation. The thought hidden at the center of Jack's response to the man before him is that Fred Marshall, being what he is, cannot harbor suspicions about anyone with whom he is on good terms. Jack's second thought is that of both a cop and a fellow citizen, and while he continues his adjustment to the third, which is wholly the product of his rusty yet still accurate cop reflexes, he makes it public. The bikes I saw outside belong to Tyler's friends. Is someone questioning them now?
Bobby Dulac, Dale says. I talked to them when they came in, but I didn't get anywhere. According to them, they were all together on Chase Street, and Tyler rode off by himself. They claim they didn't see anything. Maybe they didn't.
But you think there's more?
Honest to God, I do. But I don't know what the dickens it could be, and we have to send them home before their parents get bent out of shape.
Who are they? What are their names? Fred Marshall wraps his fingers together as if around the handle of an invisible baseball bat.
Ebby Wexler, T.J. Reniker, and Ronnie Metzger. They're the kids Ty's been hanging around with this summer.
An unspoken judgment hovers about this last sentence. It sounds like you don't consider them the best possible company for your son.
Well, no, says Fred, caught between his desire to tell the truth and his innate wish to avoid the appearance of unfairness. Not if you put it like that. Ebby seems like kind of a bully, and the other two are maybe a little on the slow side. I hope, or I was hoping, that Ty would realize he could do better and spend his free time with kids who are more on, you know,
more on his level.
Right. The trouble is, my son is sort of small for his age, and Ebby Wexler is,
heavyset and tall for his age, Jack says. The perfect situation for a bully.
You're saying you know Ebby Wexler?
No, but I saw him this morning. He was with the other two boys and your son.
Dale jolts upright in his chair, and Fred Marshall drops his invisible bat.
When was that? Dale asks. At the same time, Fred Marshall asks, where?
Chase Street, about 8:10. I came in to pick up Henry Layden and drive him home. When we were on our way out of town, the boys drove their bikes into the road right in front of me. I got a good look at your son, Mr. Marshall. He seemed like a great kid.
Fred Marshall's widening eyes indicate that some kind of hope, some promise, is taking shape before him.
Dale relaxes.
That pretty much matches their story. It would have been right before Ty took off on his own, if he did.
Or they took off and left him, says Ty's father. They were faster on their bikes than Ty, and sometimes they teased him.
By racing ahead and leaving him alone, Jack says.
Fred Marshall's glum nod speaks of boyhood humiliations shared with this sympathetic father. Jack remembers the inflamed, hostile face and raised finger of Ebby Wexler, and wonders if and how the boy might be protecting himself.
Dale had said that he smelled the presence of falsity in the boy's story, but why would they lie? Whatever their reasons, the lie almost certainly began with Ebby Wexler. The other two followed orders.
For the moment, setting aside the third of his thoughts, Jack says, I want to talk to the boys before you send them home. Where are they?
The interrogation room, top of the stairs. Dale aims a finger at the ceiling. Tom will take you up.
With its battleship gray walls, gray metal table, and single window narrow as a slit in a castle wall, the room at the top of the stairs seems designed to elicit confessions through boredom and despair. And when Tom Lund leads Jack through the door, the four inhabitants of the interrogation room appear to have succumbed to its leaden atmosphere. Bobby Dulac looks sideways, stops drumming a pencil on the tabletop, and says,
Well, hooray for Hollywood. Dale said you were coming down.
Even Bobby gleams a little less conspicuously in this gloom.
Did you want to interrogate these here hoodlums, Lieutenant?
In a minute, maybe.
Two of the three hoodlums on the far side of the table watch Jack move alongside Bobby Dulac as if fearing he will clap them in a cell. The words interrogate and lieutenant have had the bracing effect of a cold wind off Lake Michigan.
Ebby Wexler squints at Jack, trying to look tough, and the boy beside him, Ronnie Metzger, wriggles in his chair, his eyes like dinner plates. The third boy, T.J. Reniker, has dropped his head atop his crossed arms and appears to be asleep.
Wake him up, Jack says.
I have something to say, and I want you all to hear it. In fact, he has nothing to say, but he needs these boys to pay attention to him. He already knows that Dale was right. If they're not lying, they are at least holding something back. That's why his abrupt appearance within their dozy scene frightened them. If Jack had been in charge, he would have separated the boys and questioned them individually. But now he must deal with Bobby Dulac's mistake. He has to treat them collectively to begin with, and he has to work on their fear. He does not want to terrorize the boys, merely to get their hearts pumping a bit faster. After that, he can separate them. The weakest, guiltiest link has already declared himself. Jack feels no compunction about telling lies to get information. Ronnie Metzger shoves TJ's shoulder and says, "Wake up, Bumdell, dumbbell." The sleeping boy moans, lifts his head from the table, begins to stretch out his arms. His eyes fasten on Jack, and blinking and swallowing, he snaps into an upright position. "Welcome back," Jack says. "I want to introduce myself and explain what I'm doing here. My name is Jack Sawyer, and I'm a lieutenant in the Homicide Division of the Los Angeles Police Department. I have an excellent record and a room full of citations and medals. When I go after a bad guy, I usually wind up arresting him. 3 years ago, I came here on a case from Los Angeles. 2 weeks later, a man named Thornburg Kindling was shipped back to L.A. in chains. Because I know this area and have worked with its law enforcement officers, the LAPD asked me to assist your local force in its investigation of the fisherman murders." He glances down to see if Bobby Dulac is grinning at this nonsense, but Bobby is staring frozen-faced across the table. "Your friend Tyler Marshall was with you before he disappeared this morning. Did the fisherman take him? I hate to say it, but I think he did. Maybe we can get Tyler back, and maybe we can't. But if I'm going to stop the fisherman, I need you to tell me exactly what happened, down to the last detail. You have to be completely honest with me, because if you lie or keep anything secret, you will be guilty of obstruction of justice. Obstruction of justice is a serious crime. Officer Dulac, what is the minimum sentence for that crime in the state of Wisconsin?"
5 years, I'm pretty sure," Bobby Dulac says.
Ebby Wexler bites the inside of his cheek. Ronnie Metzger looks away and frowns at the table. T.J. Reniker dully contemplates the narrow window. Jack sits down beside Bobby Dulac. "Incidentally, I was the guy in the pickup one of you gave the finger to this morning. I can't say I'm thrilled to see you again." Two heads swivel toward Ebby, who squints ferociously, trying to solve this brand new problem.
"I did not," he says, having settled on outright denial. "Maybe it looked like I did, but I didn't."
"You're lying, and we haven't even started to talk about Tyler Marshall yet. I'll give you one more chance. Tell me the truth." Ebby smirks.
"I don't go around flipping the bird at people I don't know."
"Stand up," Jack says. Ebby glances from side to side, but his friends are unable to meet his gaze. He shoves back his chair and stands up uncertainly. "Officer Dulac," Jack says, "take this boy outside and hold him there." Bobby Dulac performs his role perfectly. He uncoils from his chair and keeps his eyes on Ebby as he glides toward him. He resembles a panther on the way to a sumptuous meal. Ebby Wexler jumps back and tries to stay Bobby with a raised palm.
"No, don't. I take it back. I did it, okay?"
"Too late," Jack says. He watches as Bobby grasps the boy's elbow and pulls him toward the door. Red-faced and sweating, Ebby plants his feet on the floor, and the forward pressure applied to his arm folds him over the bulge of his stomach. He staggers forward, yelping and scattering tears. Bobby Dulac opens the door and hauls him into the bleak second-floor corridor. The door slams shut and cuts off a wail of fear. The two remaining boys have turned the color of skim milk and seem incapable of movement. "Don't worry about him," Jack says. "He'll be fine. In 15-20 minutes, you'll be free to go home. I didn't think there was any point in talking to someone who lies from the get-go, that's all. Remember, even lousy cops know when they're being lied to. And I am a great cop. So this is what we're going to do now.
We're going to talk about what happened this morning, about what Tyler was doing, the way you separated from him, where you were, what you did afterward, anyone you might have seen, that kind of thing. He leans back and flattens his hands on the table. Go on, tell me what happened. Ronnie and TJ look at each other. TJ inserts his right index finger into his mouth and begins to worry the nail with his front teeth.
Ebby flipped you, Ronnie says.
No kidding. After that.
Ty said he had to go someplace.
He had to go someplace, TJ chimes in.
Where were you right then?
Outside the All Sorts Primorium.
Emporium, TJ says. It's not a Primorium, mushhead. It's an Emporium.
And?
And Ty said,
Ronnie glances at TJ,
Ty said he had to go somewhere.
Which way did he go, east or west? The boys treat this question as though it were asked in a foreign language by puzzling over it mutely. Toward the river or away from the river? They consult each other again. The question has been asked in English, but no proper answer exists. Finally, Ronnie says,
I don't know.
How about you, TJ? Do you know?
TJ shakes his head.
Good. That's honest. You don't know because you didn't see him leave, did you? And he didn't really say he had to go somewhere, did he? I bet Ebby made that up. TJ wriggles and Ronnie gazes at Jack with wondering awe. He has just revealed himself to be Sherlock Holmes. Remember when I drove past in my truck? They nod in unison. Tyler was with you. They nod again. You'd already left the sidewalk in front of the All Sorts Emporium, and you were riding east on Chase Street, away from the river. I saw you in my rearview mirror. Ebby was pedaling very fast. The two of you could almost keep up with him. Tyler was smaller than the rest of you, and he fell behind, so I know he didn't go off on his own. He couldn't keep up. Ronnie Metzger wails.
And he got way, way behind, and the Mischerfunk came out and grabbed him.
He promptly bursts into tears. Jack leans forward. Did you see it happen, either one of you?
No,
Ronnie sobs. TJ slowly shakes his head. You didn't see anyone talking with Ty, or a car stopping, or him going into a shop, or anything like that. The boys utter an incoherent, overlapping babble to the effect that they saw nothing. When did you realize he was gone? TJ opens his mouth, then closes it. Ronnie says,
when we were having the Slurpees?
His face pursed with tension, TJ nods in agreement. Two more questions reveal that they had enjoyed the Slurpees at the 7-Eleven, where they also purchased magic cards, and that it had probably taken them no more than a couple of minutes to notice Tyler Marshall's absence.
Ebby said Ty would buy us some more cards, helpful Ronnie adds.
They have reached the moment for which Jack has been waiting. Whatever the secret may be, it took place soon after the boys came out of the 7-Eleven and saw that Tyler had still not joined them. And the secret is TJ's alone. The kid is practically sweating blood, while the memory of the Slurpees and magic cards has calmed down his friend to a remarkable degree. There is only one more question he wishes to ask the two of them. So Ebby wanted to find Tyler. Did you all get on your bikes and search around, or did Ebby send just one of you?
Huh?
Ronnie says. TJ drops his chin and crosses his arms on the top of his head as if to ward off a blow.
Tyler went somewheres, Ronnie says. We didn't look for him. We went to the park to trade the magic cards.
I see, Jack says. Ronnie, thank you. You've been very helpful. I'd like you to go outside and stay with Ebby and Officer Dulac while I have a short conversation with TJ. It shouldn't take more than 5 minutes, if that.
I can go?
At Jack's nod, Ronnie moves hesitantly out of his chair. When he reaches the door, TJ emits a whimper. Then Ronnie is gone, and TJ jerks backward into his chair and tries to become as small as possible while staring at Jack with eyes that have become shiny, flat, and perfectly round. TJ, Jack says, you have nothing to worry about. I promise you. Now that he is alone with the boy who had declared his guilt by falling asleep in the interrogation room, Jack Sawyer wants, above all, to absolve him of that guilt. He knows TJ's secret, and the secret is nothing. It is useless. No matter what you tell me, I'm not going to arrest you. That's a promise, too. You're not in any trouble, son. In fact, I'm glad you and your friends could come down here and help us straighten things out. He goes on in this vein for another 3 or 4 minutes, in the course of which T.J. Reniker, formerly condemned to death by firing squad, gradually comprehends that his pardon has come through, and his release from what his buddy Ronnie would call Verinstilla is imminent. A little color returns to his face. He returns to his former size, and his eyes lose their horror-stricken glaze. "Tell me what Ebby did," Jack says, "just between you and me. I won't tell him anything, honest, I won't rat you out." "He wanted Ty to buy more magic cards," TJ says, feeling his way through unknown territory. "If Ty was there, he woulda. Ebby can get kinda mean. So he told me, go down street and get the slowpoke, or I'll give you an Indian burn." "You got on your bike and rode back down Chase Street?" "Uh-huh. I looked, but I didn't see Ty anywheres. I thought I would, you know, because where else would he be?" "And?" Jack reels in the answer he knows is coming by winding his hand through the air. "And I still didn't see him. And I got to Queen Street, where the old folks' home is with the big hedge out front, and, I saw his bike there, on the sidewalk in front of the hedge. His sneaker was there, too, and some leaves off the hedge." There it is, the worthless secret. Maybe not entirely worthless. It gives them a pretty accurate fix on the time of the boy's disappearance. 8:15, say, or 8:20. The bike lay on the sidewalk next to the sneaker for something like 4 hours before Danny Cheetah spotted them. Maxton's takes up just about all the land on that section of Queen Street, and no one was showing up for the Strawberry Fest until noon. TJ describes being afraid. If the fisherman pulled Ty into that hedge, maybe he'd come back for more. In answer to Jack's final question, the boy says, "Ebby told us to say Ty rode away from in front of the All Sorts so people wouldn't, like, blame us, in case he was killed. Ty isn't really killed, is he? Kids like Ty don't get killed."
"I hope not," Jack says.
"Me too,"
TJ snuffles and wipes his nose on his arm. "Let's get you on your way home," Jack says, leaving his chair. TJ stands up and begins to move along the side of the table.
"Oh, I just remembered."
"What?"
"I saw feathers on the sidewalk."
The floor beneath Jack's feet seems to roll left, then right, like the deck of a ship. He steadies himself by grasping the back of a chair.
"Really?"
He takes care to compose himself before turning to the boy.
"What do you mean, feathers?"
"Black ones. Big. They looked like they came off a crow. One was next to the bike, and the other was in the sneaker."
"That's funny," says Jack, buying time until he ceases to reverberate from the unexpected appearance of feathers in his conversation with T.J. Reniker. That he should respond at all is ridiculous. That he should have felt even for a second that he was likely to faint is grotesque. T.J.'s feathers were real crow feathers on a real sidewalk. His were dream feathers, feathers from unreal robins, illusory as everything else in a dream. Jack tells himself a number of helpful things like this, and soon he does feel normal once again. But we should be aware that for the rest of the night, and much of the next day, the word feathers floats, surrounded by an aura as charged as an electrical storm, beneath and through his thoughts, now and then surfacing with the sizzling crackle of a lightning bolt.
"It's weird," TJ says. "Like, how did a feather get in his sneaker?"
"Maybe the wind blew it there," Jack says, conveniently ignoring the non-existence of wind this day. Reassured by the stability of the floor, He waves TJ into the hallway, then follows him out. Abby Wexler pushes himself off the wall and stamps up alongside Bobby Dulac. Still in character, Bobby might have been carved from a block of marble. Ronnie Metzger sidles away. "We can send these boys home," Jack says. "They've done their duty."
"TJ, what did you say?"
Abby asks, glowering. "He made it clear that you know nothing about your friend's disappearance," Jack says. Abby relaxes, though not without distributing scowls all around. The final and most malignant scowl is for Jack, who raises his eyebrows.
"I didn't cry," Abby says. "I was scared, but I didn't cry."
"You were scared, all right," Jack says. "Next time, don't lie to me. You had your chance to help the police, and you blew it." Abby struggles with this notion and succeeds at least partially in absorbing it.
"Okay, but I wasn't really flipping at you. It was the stupid music."
"I hated it, too. The guy who was with me insisted on playing it. You know who he was?" In the face of Ebby's suspicious glower, Jack says, "George Rathbun." It is like saying Superman or Arnold Schwarzenegger. Ebby's suspicion evaporates and his face transforms. Innocent wonder fills his small, close-set eyes.
"You know George Rathbun?"
"He's one of my best friends," Jack says, not adding that most of his other best friends are, in a sense, also George Rathbun.
"Cool,"
Abby says. In the background, TJ and Ronnie echo,
"Cool."
"George is pretty cool," Jack says. "I'll tell him you said that. Let's go downstairs and get you kids on your bikes." Still wrapped in the glory of having gazed upon the great, the tremendous George Rathbun, the boys mount their bicycles, pedal away down Sumner Street, and swerve off into Second. Bobby Dulac says,
"That was a good trick, what you said about George Rathbun. Sent them away happy."
"It wasn't a trick." So startled that he jostles back into the station house side by side with Jack, Bobby says,
"George Rathbun is a friend of yours?"
"Yep," Jack says. "And sometimes he can be a real pain in the ass." Dale and Fred Marshall look up as Jack enters the office. Dale with a cautious expectancy, Fred Marshall with what Jack sees heartbreakingly as hope.
"Well," Dale says, feathers, "you were right, they were hiding something. But it isn't much."
Fred Marshall slumps against the back of his chair, letting some of his belief in a future hope leak out of him like air from a punctured tire. "Not long after they got to the 7-Eleven, the Wexler boy sent TJ down the street to look for your son," Jack says. "When TJ got to Queen Street, he saw the bike and the sneaker lying on the sidewalk. Of course, they all thought of the fishermen. Abby Wexler figured they might get blamed for leaving him behind, and he came up with the story you heard, that Tyler left them instead of the other way around. If you saw all four boys around 8:10, that means Tyler disappeared only a few minutes later. What does this guy do, lurk in hedges?"
"Maybe he does exactly that," Jack says. "Did you have people check out that hedge, feathers?
The Stadies went over it, through it, and under it.
Leaves and dirt, that's what they came up with."